3, 2, 1, 0. From the studios of WORQ in Wisconsin, this is the Stand Up for the Truth podcast. Today's issues, overlooked headlines, and biblical observations, equipping the remnant around the globe. Got your sword handy? This is Stand Up for the Truth.
Andy Crash Connell, it is Friday, May 3rd, 2024. Got a brand new podcast, first-time guest with Mary Danielson today.
Good morning. I have Dr. Ingrid Skop this morning, and you will see she's on the front lines in the battle for life in defending the defenseless and advocating for women. She's with the Charlotte Lozier Institute, and they advise and lead the pro-life movement with groundbreaking scientific and medical research. And then they leverage this research to educate policymakers and the media and the public on the value of life at any age. And so we're going to talk to her this morning. My scripture is Psalm 112, 1 to 4. And it says, "Praise the Lord. Blessed is the man who fears the Lord, who delights greatly in his commandments. His descendants will be mighty on the earth. The generation of the upright will be blessed. Wealth and riches will be in his house, and his righteousness endures forever. Unto the upright there arises light in the darkness. He is gracious and full of compassion and righteous." Would you pray with me this morning? Lord, we thank you that you are light, and in you is no darkness at all. And we really desire to reflect that light to the culture around us. And we ask that you direct our steps and fill us with your spirit for the work that you have for each of us. We lift up Dr. Skop to you. Thank you for her tireless work on behalf of those who have no voice, the least of these. We pray for endurance for her in the war and for good health and protection for her and her loved ones. In Jesus' name, amen. Ingrid Skop, MD, is Vice President and Director of Medical Affairs for the Charlotte Lozier Institute. Leveraging more than 30 years of experience as a practicing OBGYN to support research and policies that respect the dignity of every human life. She's a fellow of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, where she uses science and statistics to counter pro-abortion agendas, and she's a lifetime member of the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists. And she has served for over 25 years in private practice in San Antonio, a board member and medical director for pregnancy resource centers in San Antonio and Austin and Houston. And her research on women's health has been published in multiple peer-reviewed journals. And she's provided expert testimony at both the state and federal levels on legislation related to abortion. Dr. Skop, welcome to Stand Up for the Truth.
Thank you. It is so good to be with you today.
Now, I'm going to set the stage here for what we want to talk about, which is the abortion kill pill. In 2000, when the FDA initially approved it, it required mothers to meet in person with doctors, and they would provide ongoing care, including in-person visits to check for complications, and it required them to report serious complications. But Biden's FDA stripped away the safeguards, and so without these safeguards, there was no limit to the access to this pill. But with any drug, there's always the potential for safety issues. How can that not be true, and especially for this one? So, Dr. Skop, I'm going to ask you first to tell us about mifepristone. How does it work?
So the regimen that the FDA has approved is actually two pills. Mifepristone is the more tightly regulated one. It blocks progesterone receptors in the uterus, so it cuts off the hormonal support and kills the embryo or the fetus. It's followed in about 24 to 48 hours by misoprostol that induces contractions to expel the tissue. Okay. It's a terrible experience for women. The average woman will bleed heavily for about 2 weeks. Almost half describe the pain as severe because their bodies are going into labor. Mm-hmm. And so many of these women will see their aborted child. The complications are high, four times as many complications as surgical abortions. And we see, you mentioned the initial approval. Even the initial approval was highly politicized. It was the Population Council that brought it over from France under President Clinton, and they approved it in a rush using accelerated approval regulations that required them to redefine pregnancy as a life-threatening illness for which there was no other treatment. So we can see that it's not to the benefit of women, but it benefits the abortion industry It solves their staffing problems because they were having trouble finding doctors willing to kill.
Mm. Is this the original of RU486?
That was its name in France.
Okay.
So yes, that is exactly the same drug.
Okay. Now, how many, what are the statistics on chemical abortions? What do they account for of all the abortions, say, in the last year or so?
Well, I think it's important to recognize, number one, that there is nothing about abortion data collection in our country that is mandated on a federal level.
Okay.
So everything we have is our best estimate.
Okay.
Because there are some people who really don't want to know the answer to that question. The Guttmacher Institute, which is the mouthpiece for the abortion industry, told us that last year there were more than 1 million abortions in our country and that 630,000 of them were using these abortion drugs.
Wow. Wow. That's, over 60%, I'm thinking. And I want to talk about the dangers of it. They claim, activists claim that this is safer than Tylenol for the mother. Wow, that's kind of a to their shame, I guess we would say.
Yeah, what they do, of course, this is a talking point to steer women into this action. And again, if a woman qualifies, they're really being pushed toward these abortion drugs where they're self-managing their own abortion, which, of course, we used to be told that was a bad thing. But today, apparently, that's a good thing for the abortion industry. Mm-hmm. Complications are common. About 6% of women, even when used as required by the FDA, and we'll discuss that that's not being done anymore either, 6% will not be able to extrude all of the tissue.
Mm.
They will require surgery. About 15% of women will have a clinical hemorrhage. They bleed very, very heavy. Infection can happen, and in fact, there is a black box warning on the drug mifepristone. That's the FDA's highest warning, where they warn doctors that women can have a serious infection that can kill them without the standard warning signs of fever, elevated white blood cell count, and pelvic pain. So in fact, rather than being safer than Tylenol, of course, Tylenol does not have a black box warning, but the only reason they're able to even make that statement is that deaths following abortion are dramatically undercounted in our country. The CDC uses death certificates to collect its maternal mortality data, and you can see that there might be many reasons that a death certificate would not record an abortion because women are often embarrassed to talk about it.
Mm.
And deaths can occur up to a year after the end of the pregnancy. So there's no way of counting mental health deaths, which high-quality studies tell us a woman is 6 times as likely to commit suicide in the year following an abortion than following childbirth. But anyway, they compare those undercounted deaths that the CDC reports to Americans who die of Tylenol overdoses.
Mm.
So we can see how dishonest that statement is.
Wow. Emergency room visits, certainly, I would guess, would be up quite a bit with this. Do we know any numbers? I know like the numbers are difficult here, but emergency room visits are up with this drug?
Yeah, absolutely. So the CDC's, the FDA's own data did document that approximately 1 out of 25 women were seen in an emergency room following these drugs.
Mm.
But several things have happened and more dangerous. In 2021, as you mentioned, under President Biden, using the COVID pandemic as an excuse, the FDA removed all in-person supervision. So these drugs can now be ordered online. They can be sent through the mail.
Mm.
And we see now that we have states protecting unborn life, this was the plan all along.
Oh.
So doctors in New York State are mailing them into my state of Texas, injuring women. And, of course, those women have no abortion provider to return to. They probably never even knew who sent them the drugs in the first place because mm-hmm. these are just websites. And so they have to go to an emergency room when they have a complication. I'm seeing more women injured by abortion drugs since Texas began protecting unborn life than I saw beforehand. So apparently that was all part of the plan. That is the reason, by the way, for the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine versus FDA lawsuit that was recently heard by the Supreme Court. These are doctors like myself, Hippocratic practitioners who do not electively end human life, who are being called in to care for these women, to pick up the pieces when these abortions go awry. And we said, it's inappropriate what the FDA has done. No ultrasound, no documentation of gestational age, no ruling out of a potentially deadly ectopic pregnancy,
right.
No labs to prevent future pregnancy complications by giving Rogam, and no face-to-face counseling to determine, is it even a woman ordering these drugs, or is it a sex trafficker? Does she know that there are alternatives, that there are 3,000 pregnancy centers in our country that would love to support her if she wants to give birth to her child?
Mm.
Does she know the risk? Of course she doesn't, because we don't even know the risk, because nobody is collecting that data. The FDA in 2016 said they didn't want to hear about any more complications unless it killed a woman.
Wow. Wow. Well, in 2023, then, the Fifth District Court of Appeals took up this case of Biden's FDA ruling. This was a part of a lawsuit. And who brought that lawsuit?
So that was the Pro-Life Doctors, the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, representing several pro-life medical organizations, the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists, Christian Medical and Dental, Catholic Medical Association, Coptic Medical Association.
Okay. All right. And then the Fifth Circuit Court, they reinstated some safety measures, limiting the use of the abortion kill pill to the first 7 weeks, ending mail order chemical abortions, and requiring in-person medical visits prior to it actually being prescribed. So bring us up to date on this now. Who is Danko? And what is going on, or what went on in March when the U.S. Supreme Court decided to review the Fifth Circuit Court's decision?
So Danko is the company that manufactures Mifeprex, the name brand of Mifepristone. And again, it's the only drug they make. They were created by the Population Council specifically for population control measures through abortion.
Did not know that.
Yes, isn't that interesting? The history is fascinating, the eugenic and population control ideology behind it all.
Yes.
But that's Danko. Initially, when the case went in the Amarillo court, the judge there found our data compelling. He said this drug should have never been approved and put an injunction on it. Of course, it went up to the Fifth Circuit, and they also agreed our data was compelling, but they said, you know, it's been 24 years since it was approved. What we should do is put it back to where those safeguards were in place, like you mentioned, early, prescribed by a doctor, mandatory complication reporting, really common sense things, a follow-up visit to make sure that there have been no complications, an in-person visit before the drugs are given. It went to the Supreme Court, and I think we all can recognize that the United States Supreme Court has been beaten up over the issue of abortion. We saw in the wake of the Dobbs decision how their lives and their families were threatened. And the arguments at the Supreme Court were not so much about the data, but were about, do the doctors like myself who are caring for these injured women, do we have standing to bring a lawsuit? It was very interesting. Justice Alito asked the government's attorney, if these doctors don't have standing, who does have standing to bring a lawsuit against the FDA? And her answer was, no one has standing to bring a lawsuit against the FDA. They are the experts, and they should be allowed, essentially, to do their job without any oversight. And I think regardless of how you feel about abortion, that is a very concerning statement to make. And of course, we all saw in the past 4 years with the pandemic how many mistakes were made by these government bureaucracies.
Right.
They must be subjected to oversight. But unfortunately, I'm a little concerned that the justices, in order to avoid ruling on another abortion case, which of course is going to initiate quite a bit of drama, that they may be tempted to say that we don't have standing. But I'm praying for courage. I'm praying that they address this issue. It's very, very important. And, we need to do the right thing regardless of where the chips fall in this country.
Wow. So March 26th was the hearing to overturn this Fifth Circuit decision. So there were some shocking things that went on, and I want to hear from you. some of the key takeaways, but this article, four shocking admissions from the U.S. Supreme Court abortion pill case oral arguments. The first one is FDA claimed to have sovereign immunity from lawsuits. I was not aware that that was actually true, although I probably should have been considering Big Pharma and who they are, and I've done a lot of research on them. But I'd like to hear from you. What are some of the key takeaways? And then after we go through those, do we know when a decision will be made?
Yeah, absolutely. So like you say, the sovereign immunity is saying that this fourth branch of government, these bureaucracies, should have no oversight, that there are no checks and balances on them, which, of course, I hope we can see that that should be false.
Yeah, yeah.
One thing that was very interesting about the arguments is that the government did allow that we as pro-life doctors did have conscious protections, because anybody who's been following some of the actions of the Biden administration has seen that in many cases they're trying to force doctors to do abortions. There's mm-hmm. another case in front of the Supreme Court this term where they used a law called EMTALA to try to force doctors. It was unnecessary because every state that protects unborn life does allow a doctor to intervene if he needs to protect a woman's life.
Mm-hmm.
So there's really no difference, you know, between how we've always treated emergencies and how we treat emergencies now, because, again, most obstetricians do not perform abortion.
Yeah.
So that was good to hear that they were saying that we should have conscious protections, but they also don't understand how medicine works. If I'm the doctor who's on call in the middle of the night and a woman comes in hemorrhaging and I need to take her immediately to the operating room, I don't have time to call in a pro-abortion peer.
Right.
You know, that's not going to happen. So the reality is that we are going to continue to care for these women who've been harmed. But the ruling from the Supreme Court will probably come out at the end of this term.
Okay.
That'll be late June. But again, the decision, even if they've already voted, they can always change their mind.
Oh.
So until that ruling comes out, there is still the opportunity for courage and for changing their mind in support of protecting human life.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that even if the Supreme Court does rule with the Fifth Circuit, putting those safeguards back in place, this does not take the drugs off the market,
okay,
but it does put the guardrails back in place, which will make it safer for women. Of course, not safer for that child who's killed. And we really, as a country, need to start having the conversation about how many ways abortion harms women.
Mm-hmm.
The very first thing we need to do is start protecting some of these women, because they do have, in many cases, horrible complications. And how many women are at home alone in pain, seeing their child, being told mm-hmm. not to talk about it? So we've got a generation of women that are just being emotionally damaged because of what the FDA has allowed.
What a disaster on every possible level. And these four shocking admissions, one of them says FDA portrays tens of thousands of abortion pill ER visits as small. I'm guessing numbers don't matter to them. This is all about pragmatism. I mean, to put it mildly, I guess, but so it doesn't really matter if you bring statistics, right?
Well, I exactly. And I'll tell you about that. I think what we've seen is that the ideology, the goal of ending unborn life, obviously is trumping the collateral damage that women are suffering.
Yeah.
But let's talk about these numbers. Again, 630,000 chemical abortions last year. The FDA's own data says 1 out of 25 end up in an emergency room. By the way, at Charlotte Lozier, we published very, very high-quality studies, records linkage, where we knew the women that had had abortions, we knew the complications that occurred, and we documented similarly that 1 out of 20 of them went to an emergency room within a month. But the abortion advocates say, well, some of them might go for reassurance, or maybe not all of them require treatment.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we all recognize, if we know anything about our overburdened emergency room system right now, you know, 1 out of 25 women out of 630,000, that's a lot of ER visits.
It is.
That is overburdening our system. And our study also demonstrates something really shocking. 60% of the time, these known abortion drug complications were miscoded as a miscarriage. So women are ashamed to talk about it.
Sure.
Doctors may assume it was a miscarriage and not an abortion pill. And in fact, the abortion industry tells women, you can pretend it's a miscarriage if you need to seek treatment. Doctors can't tell the difference.
Wow.
But the reality is there is differences in the way that they're treated. And our study also showed that these women required 3 emergency room visits on average before they got the surgery that they needed. But I want to tell you, because of the politicized world that we live in, our high-quality studies were targeted, they were retracted, and for no good reason, other they said that we didn't report our conflicts of interest, even though on the front page of each of our papers it showed that we were affiliated with Charlotte Lozier and the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists. So obviously, if anybody wanted to know if we were pro-life, it was right there on the front page.
Yeah.
But now we've got this ideology that says pro-life researchers can't do good research, and that, and of course, the same standards don't apply to the pro-abortion research, which is all the other research out there. But this is the world that we're living in. If you put out data that does not promote the ending of unborn human life, you were targeted.
Yeah.
So here we are.
Wow. I'm speaking with Dr. Ingrid Skop, LozierInstitute.org, if you're interested in looking at the research and reading some articles on this. Here's another one. Dr. Skop, Judge Clarence Thomas grilled Danco attorney Jessica Ellsworth on why the FDA did not take into account the Comstock Act, a federal law which prohibits the mailing of abortion-inducing drugs. And now this abortion pill manufacturer says that restricting sales is going to injure their business. Oh, my. I can't drum up any sympathy for that. But what about the Comstock Act? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the Comstock, I mean, I'm not an attorney, but I know it has been discussed. It's an older law that prohibits mailing anything that could perform an abortion. So it seems to me quite clear that mailing these drugs in the mail, in addition to being very, very poor quality medicine, no medical supervision, is illegal. But we all recognize we live in a country right now where the federal government does not necessarily desire to follow the law if it conflicts with their ideology. So there may be a point in time when we can use the Comstock Act to regulate these drugs, but right now I'm telling you, they are everywhere. There are dozens of websites that will mail these. And in fact, as I mentioned, you know, some of the blue states like New York, not only do they have abortionists breaking the law to mail them, they have passed what they call shield laws protecting their abortionist. So if an abortionist sends drugs into Texas and kills a woman, there's no extradition for that doctor.
Wow.
There's no wrongful death lawsuit. There's no medical malpractice lawsuit. No ability to impact her license or her malpractice insurance. So they're going totally the other way. Half of our country is trying to protect unborn life. The other half is trying to remove any protection for that child until the moment of birth. And in fact, some of these states have even are even looking at legislation that would protect a doctor who fails to kill a baby in an abortion. The baby's born alive. He kills the baby after birth. They're now looking to protect those doctors. So we really, you know, I think we have an ideological civil war on our hands in this country, in that, you know, we're just, it's become extreme. It's no longer safe, legal, and rare. It's now, we don't care if it's safe, if it's illegal, we still want it to be common, and that's what these abortion drugs are all about.
Wow. Incredible. It's just wicked. I see shock number 4 here in this list of shocking admissions from the Supreme Court abortion pill case oral arguments, where the attorney for Danco was asked, do you think the FDA is infallible? And Judge Alito asked them. She says, no, Your Honor. Has the FDA ever approved a drug and then pulled it after experience showed that had a lot of really serious adverse consequences? And she says it has done that, pointing to the adverse events reported under the REMS. And I'm not sure there's a lot of legal jargon here, but I mean, she was asked outright, do you think that they are infallible? But that's not the impression I get that they think of themselves.
Yeah, and I think what we have seen, and this was demonstrated quite obviously during COVID, at times there were FDA committees making recommendations, for example, don't use the COVID shot in young children. There's no benefit and perhaps harm. And then we saw the FDA overrule their own experts. So it's clear to me that many of our government bureaucracies have become ideologically captured. That doesn't mean that everybody there, I mean, I think that there are good people who understand science, who are working hard to try to protect the American public from dangerous drugs, which is the FDA's mission. But at some level, either the leadership or perhaps political pressure from outside is overriding safety concerns for reasons of politics and ideology, and that should concern all of us.
It should indeed. An article came out just a week or so ago, stunner in fourth place among America's leading causes of death. And it says, a new report has revealed a real stunner in fourth place among America's leading causes of death, the abortions from Planned Parenthood. The leading player in the nation's lucrative abortion industry said in its annual 22-23 report that the corporation ended the lives of nearly 393,000 during a single year. SBA Pro-Life America President Marjorie Dannenfelser quickly pointed out the unwelcome significance of that figure because their business is abortion, of course, but how can that not, when you see that number, Dr. Scott, how can that not just, have a terrible effect on, it's very sobering. In other words, it's sort of a knife in the heart when you see that 393,000 Americans.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hope people are seeing that, and I hope they're really thinking about what that means. Approximately 97% of abortions in our country are in healthy mothers and healthy babies. Mm-hmm. And almost all of those, the reason is economic and social. Sure. And so we, of course, this is a human life. There's no scientific doubt about that. So our country, which used to be a Christian country and calls itself moral, is allowing the elective ending of human life for social and financial reasons, which is terrifying, really, because we know how God punished the children of Israel for doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. The church needs to get engaged. Sadly, I think too many Christians feel this is a political issue.
Yeah.
It's uncomfortable to talk about. They don't want to talk about it. But I think if the church doesn't engage on this issue, we're not going to be able to make the point, the moral point. Mm-hmm. And I would say one other thing. We also produced a study recently looking at late abortions around the world. There are only 8 countries that are members of the UN that allow abortions for any reason at any time in pregnancy, and we are one of them.
Mm, wow.
So, you know, people say, oh, that doesn't happen, or it only happens for compelling reasons. No, 90% of late abortions happen for elective, financial, and social reasons. And I would say from talking to women, very often those are women who are being coerced into an abortion.
Mm.
They want their baby, but at some point they can't hide their pregnancy any longer.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a coercive parent or a coercive man forces them into an abortion. So shame on us for letting that happen. Obviously, that's not happening in every state, but at least half of our states, that is a possibility.
Wow. And the pregnant women who walk into Planned Parenthood are just sold an abortion almost 100% of the time. They're not being given any options or anything like that. And tax money, too. Dr. Scott, tax money being used to fund Planned Parenthood is just abominable. And what can we do? We have about a minute left. What can we do? I guess pray. And what else do you suggest? That's the number one, right?
I think prayer is number one. Yeah. I think education is number two. Come to LozierInstitute.org and read. We've got quite a bit of really deep dive data on our website. But number three, I think, is to engage. Engage your friends. Talk about it. Engage your pastor. Encourage the pastor to address this from the pulpit. 16% of Christians who go to church regularly do have an abortion in their history.
Yeah.
So they need forgiveness. They need reconciliation. And also find out where the Pregnancy Resource Center nearest to you is. Donate and volunteer time. They're walking alongside women, helping them.
Helping them
to have their babies.
Yeah, and pray for the Supreme Court decision. Also, we have some time that we can do that. Dr. Scott, thank you so much. You know, we all know abortion is out there, but to actually talk to you and to understand how this is continuing on, we really need to be educated on that. So thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
God bless you, dear. All right, second half, we're going to have some headlines this morning. So stay with me. 2-minute break, and we'll be right back.
Feedback, questions, and topic suggestions are always appreciated. Email us at comments@standupforthetruth.com.
Welcome back to Stand Up for the Truth for this Friday, May the 3rd. Got some headlines in this half, and I want to open up with this morning's headline. Israeli warplanes strike Damascus as Iran tensions still on edge. So just because Israel's not in the headlines as much, and we're talking about those students on campus and the trouble they're causing, this is a new development on the outskirts of Damascus on late Thursday. And the article says this fresh Israeli aggression could be another targeted assassination operation against Iranian generals or IRGC officers. Well, we'll just have to wait to see what happens there, because Iran has definitely said, don't try anything more. But, of course, they are going to do what they need to do. And I think we all agree with that. So I want to dive into something called the UN 2.0 coming this fall, from a very lengthy article out there from Prophecy News Watch. And it's no secret how useless the UN has been since its founding to actually either be a global governance facilitator or actually, how about this, serve the people of the earth in any useful manner beyond their globalist, Marxist, dictatorial aspirations. Well, recently, the UN Secretary General announced his vision for a modernized UN. He intends to unveil it at the Summit of the Future on September 22nd and 23rd this year, and this has been in the planning for a while, since 2022. The agenda behind the agenda, well, it's to complete Agenda 2030 and implement the Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs, which are failing. Oh, that's too bad. Only 12% of them are on track to be completed, with many stalled or going the wrong direction. Now, he's lamenting that their goal of implementing all of them by 2030 is unlikely at this point. And so this summit, I guess, is intended to pour some accelerant on that process and to take some decisive action. So I'm just going to, I want to call your attention to portions of it. It is very long. UN 2.0 coming this fall, setting the stage for global government. It says a UN document on the summit of the future entitled, What Would It Deliver? We all have that question. Discusses the concept of an updated UN and what it would mean for the future. It's about upgraded expertise in innovation, data, digital, foresight, and behavioral science to enhance UN systems results, help build similar member state expertise, and accelerate shared progress toward the SDGs. And most of that is absolutely gobbledygook. So we'll straighten out that curve a little bit for you, hopefully. This document calls for a global financial system that works for all. And now these SDGs, Sustainable Development Goals, there are three core elements. There are 17 of them. I'm not going to read them all. You can find them online. But the three core elements, in other words, what they will all fall into is economic growth, social inclusion, and environmental protection. And it has to do with no poverty for anyone, no hunger, no global citizen will go hungry, good health, guaranteed for all. I don't know how they can guarantee that. Quality education for all. Gender equality, of course. It dives into all that. Clean energy, climate action, sustainable cities. And we all know what that means. 15-minute cities, that sort of thing. Cyber cities. One of the other stated goals of the 2023 summit was to transform the entire international financial system by adapting the International Monetary Fund and World Bank to modern challenges. So they're going to get an upgrade too, apparently. I know this will cost an absolute fortune. Secretary General Guterres, he said these goals correspond with recent statements made by Guterres, okay, where he called for a new Bretton Woods moment, referencing the infamous 1944 international agreement that established the IMF and adopted rules for governing monetary relations among independent states. Okay. And it would require each nation to guarantee convertibility of their currencies into dollars, which fascinates me because the dollar is on the way out. Depending on what you read here, CBDCs, global CBDCs, are next. Let me continue on with this article. It says, for those reading between the lines and seeing through the buzzwords, the language of these documents rings of globalist speak, intended to override or outlaw national and individual sovereignty in favor of world government. Simple enough. a new monetary system, a renewal of the multilateral system. All of this is designed to sell the public on the idea that the UN or some new international body is needed to take humanity safely into the future. In truth, we are likely to see more steps towards the creation of a one-world government at the summit of the future. The website notes that it will conclude with a pact for the future, which will be endorsed by heads of state at the summit. The outcome of the pact will be a world and an international system that is better prepared to manage the challenges we face now. And, of course, it's another piece in the shift towards a world government by unelected international politicians. Okay, this pact for the future. It says the aim of the summit is to accelerate efforts to meet our existing international commitments. Okay. In January, Germany and Namibia, co-facilitators of the summit, announced the release of the zero draft of the Pact for the Future. These proposals mostly repeat what is found in the UN's 75th anniversary document. Let's see what we got here. And the Common Agenda Report. Okay, the document makes it clear that the member states reaffirm the importance of a multilateral system, whatever that is. The draft says the UN will commit to a vision of a multilateral system. Boy, the gobbledygook here is amazing. And that the world must adapt to new forms of governance. Okay, so then it mentions a need for an emergency platform. I'll get this. That would be activated in the event of, quote, such a shock that has an impact on multiple regions of the world, and according to the UN, requires a coherent, coordinated, and multidimensional response. Such a shock. What would that be? Okay, they claim it's going to be an environmental shock of what sort that would impact most of the world. I don't know. Of course, I'm going to suggest the rapture would be such a shock. But I want to camp here, this planetary emergency. There's a whole section in this article about that. And it's become increasingly used by the UN and aligned organizations to describe their belief that the planet is passing from various states of crisis to emergencies from which humanity might not return. I don't know why they are saying that. They have absolutely no evidence. They have nothing to stand on there because of its climate. They're just making it up anyway. But humanity might not return from that unless drastic action is taken. They have many opinion pieces out there calling for a formal declaration of planetary emergency by the UN General Assembly at this summit in September. So they might actually just go ahead and declare that. So we want to keep an eye on that. The calls for a declaration of an emergency have also reached the White House. Last week, Bloomberg reported that the Biden admin is considering declaring a climate emergency. There you have it. The White House officials have renewed discussions about potentially declaring a national climate emergency that would unlock federal powers to stifle oil development. Surprise. The Biden administration has treated the climate crisis as an emergency since day one. If Biden does not declare an emergency, he would not be the first. If Biden does declare an emergency, he would not be the first president to do so. In fact, past presidents have declared national emergencies for various reasons. However, calls for a so-called climate emergency are unprecedented. Yeah, you think so, hey? UN Secretary General says we also confront a planetary emergency, including growing population, collapsing biodiversity, threatening the environment on which everyone's future depends. The Climate Governance Commission, whoever they are, they're a UN-affiliated organization. They're also getting in on the fun, it says here. In September 23, during Climate Week at the UN Summit, this CGC released a statement titled Charting a Safe Path for a Workable Future. And they say, of course, that the world faces a deepening planetary emergency, and we are on a reckless path towards catastrophic climate change, already overstepping 6 of 9 scientifically identified planetary boundaries. All the jargon knows no end here. So we have planetary boundaries. I don't know about you, but I was not aware of that. So the CGC was convened by Maya Groff. She's a member of the Global Governance Forum. So many organizations, you can't even keep this alphabet soup straight. with extensive connections to technocratic, including Rockefeller Foundation, who have helped finance the work of the CGC. No more surprises there. They also continue to call for expanding concepts of global governance. Yeah, they're all in it together. And, of course, in order to do that, we are to deploy new levels of collective wisdom and political courage to tackle existential planetary risks. It also includes the usual climate alarmism and doomsday predictions. Oh, I like this one. The CGC says the world may have only 6 or 7 years to change course. Well, you know what? I'm going to go along with that number of about 7 years to change course, and Jesus is going to change course of this nonsense sooner or later. So that's what they're claiming, 6 or 7 years to get through this climate crisis. A basic premise of the CGC is that new perspectives on global governments employing new levels of, like I said, wisdom and courage. This effort should complement and enhance ongoing intergovernmental negotiations. Wow, what a bunch of gobbledygook. We therefore urge the UN General Assembly at the 2024 Summit of the Future to declare a planetary emergency, recognizing that the triple planetary crisis poses a grave risk to global stability. You get the idea. I don't know what these planetary boundaries is. Let's see what they are. The Pact for the Future and the CGC's report governing our planetary emergency are both built on the concept of planetary boundaries, first popularized by Johan Rockström, former director of the Stockholm Resilience Center. He first developed the idea with a group of 28 internationally renowned scientists in 2009. Okay, so we're going to follow the science on this too. No reason to trust it, but they're going to make us follow it. Rockström's concept presents a set of 9 planetary boundaries within which humanity can continue to develop and thrive for generations to come. According to this theory, the Earth's planetary boundaries indicate the maximum human-induced disruption each environmental area can sustain before it becomes unstable, leading to irreversible changes and cascading effects in multiple domains. They are just going to sell this. And I think the average person is just scratching their head about this. As with calls for planetary emergency, in recent years, support for these concept of boundaries has grown among academia, science, and some politicians. And, of course, support for global government. Now it says, it ends, this very long article ends with, all roads lead to the Club of Rome and eugenics. There we go. We can trace the call for planetary emergency back to the infamous but obscure group, the Club of Rome. The CGC's November 2023 report even notes that the belief in a polycrisis or multiple simultaneous crises is recognized in the work of the Club of Rome Planetary Emergency Project. You may remember they were formed in 1970, and they also suggested 10 regions of government at that time that would make it easier to govern the planet. And that was a long time ago. And, of course, David Rockefeller is the one who founded the Club of Rome. He passed away several years ago at the age of 101, of the infamous Rockefellers who have been throwing their massive wealth at every possible global thing they can come up with themselves. He also formed the Trilateral Commission. So this should raise red flags, this reference to the Club of Rome. And so the public ought to be concerned with this push for planetary emergencies. That, I don't know about you, but there's no way I'm going to swallow that. They have a planet, Club of Rome has a planetary emergency plan that they published in 2019, after the beginning of some other viruses that went around at that time. So we have to, of course, include viruses and bugs and all that. It's just insanity. And the article ends with, as with the zero draft of the Pact for the Future and the Climate Governance Commission's 2023 report, the Club of Rome calls on nations to declare a planetary emergency and to adopt a plan. So even if the one in May with the pandemic plan doesn't go through, they're going to have so many backup systems here. It doesn't matter if one fails. There will be plenty in place to make this happen. So SDGs are not happening, and they're unhappy about that. So look for the UN 2.0 coming this fall. And why do the nations rage and the peoples plot a vain thing, and God sits in heaven and laughs? So we know what he thinks of all this. And, of course, we're watching for Jesus to come and take the church on the agenda, and there is your planetary crisis. All right, I'm going to move on to something a little bit different here. An mRNA article on mRNA in cancer. This is very sobering. And it says all mRNA injections, including cancer vaccines, may accelerate the development of cancer. 4 days ago, The Guardian reported that there was excitement among patients and researchers in the UK as, quote, personalized mRNA vaccines for cancer entered a phase three trial. Excuse me. On Monday, an article was published about a personalized mRNA skin cancer vaccine that may also be effective against lung, bladder, and kidney cancer. However, patients may be less excited about these groundbreaking injections when they read a paper published last week. On April 23rd, a preprint paper, which means not yet peer-reviewed, was published in a medical journal that reviewed oncogenesis and autoimmunity caused by mRNA injections. It found that repeated mRNA injections reduce immune surveillance for cancer, while at the same time inducing autoimmunity. Autoimmunity may sound good, but I'm sure you realize that autoimmune disorders are a problem. Autoimmunity is an immune response resulting from a failure of our immune system to recognize our own cells and tissues as self. It's when our body turns on us. The paper extensively reviewed the role of regulatory T cells, Treg cells, in the immune system with a particular focus on the disruption of their behavior caused by mRNA injections. Treg cells modulate the immune system and prevent autoimmune disease. They also suppress the immune response to cancer and have been shown to contribute to the development and progression of the disease. The paper found that post-vaccination, the subsequent spike protein expression may lead to a harmful influence on the immune system of the vaccinees and subsequent accelerated development of cancer and autoimmune. And the turbo cancers resulting from these mRNAs is just tragic. People are, and young people especially, are being diagnosed with stage 4 cancers just like that. It comes on so quickly. And how terrifying that must be. And Dr. Peter McCullough has an article, Oncogenesis and Autoimmunity as a Result of mRNA COVID-19 Vaccine. And this is real short. He says, every cancer registry in the world is up with new cases and documented rapid progression of disease, aptly termed turbo cancer. The trend line went up with the rollout of genetic COVID-19 vaccines. What mechanism could explain an injection of Pfizer or Moderna mRNA and the genesis of cancer? In other words, repeated injections of mRNA are taking down immune surveillance for malignant cells while at the same time inducing autoimmunity. So that's from Dr. Peter McCullough. And you can find research on that online, but it is not good news. Also, Dr. McCullough. He said, expect an avalanche of COVID shot dementia. And this is also something that we are dealing with ever since these vaccines rolled out. Dr. Joseph McCullough, an expert on natural health remedies and avowed critic of the government-mandated COVID shots that were imposed on the American public, is now warning about the evidence of a high link between those shots and dementia. At his website, he discusses his research and research by others into the links, often devastating, that are being confirmed between the COVID shots that governments and corporations demanded citizens take, with some, as we all know, very bad outcomes. Among those is dementia and other related mental issues. And here's a quote. According to mounting data, one of the more serious side effects appears to be dementia. And this previously untransmissible disease may now be contagious, transmissible by the way of prions. And now we're getting into meadowbabble here that I don't understand. But he did an interview with Stephanie Seneff, a PhD, and she explained why she suspected they may eventually result in an avalanche of neurological-based diseases such as Alzheimer's. And she published a paper dealing with those mechanisms in May of 2021. And they talk about here, Mercola's notes, note the evidence now confirms a side effect of these jabs could be dementia. and the prions that cause it may be contagious. These are perilous times. I don't know how else to put that. We've been told that it will be perilous times in the scripture, but who saw any of this coming? It's just wickedness. Frame shifting, as we now know, occurs in the COVID shots, can induce prion production and lead to neurodegenerative diseases. His warning is some clinical trials and observational studies suggest the safety of the shots are biased, and those conclusions are massively overstated. He said prions are, I'm not even going to go into the meadow babble, but they can cause Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease in humans too, and mad cow disease in cattle, chronic wasting disease in deer and elk, and they form holes in the brain, giving it a sponge-like appearance, and then it doesn't induce an inflammatory response. So Mercola also noted a recent study in the journal Vaccine about the side effects of COVID jabs, and it confirms what I and many other alternative news sources have been saying all along, that they are the most dangerous medical product to ever hit the market. And there is no going back. It just seems like, you know, if they want to put mRNA and grow it in our food and put it in every vaccine out there, how in the world is humanity going to navigate this? It's just phenomenal. And we know that we are in the times of the end and the Lord is coming soon. But meanwhile, these are things that the world has never seen. And we're, you know, the tribulation is a time such as Earth has never, ever seen before. And we're just getting a glimpse of that, just a bare glimpse of that. One more article we have time for here, imminent insect demise. Now, when they say imminent insect demise, there's just a lot of drama involved there. But the global food web is very tenuous, and even the supply chain. We talk about the supply chain being a problem, and what about the truckers, and what about all this and that? Well, on so many different levels, even changes in the insect communities is a potential for incredible famine. GMOs had the potential for incredible famines. The newest report from the World Entomology Body is absolutely frightening. Buried in the late Friday afternoon news cycle, the most recent annual assessment available of insect health indicates that loss of whole insect communities is imminent, which will have disastrous effects for the global food web. And it gives a variety of factors for that: loss and fragmentation of their habitat, pollution from light, microplastics and synthetic pesticides, which probably would get my vote here, the spread of pathogens and other parasites, the climate crisis, well, we just talked about that, but it says these stressors drove the demise of the world's insect biodiversity. There's also an awful lot of digital signal in the air. I don't know if that messes with birds and bees and their homing devices that God has built into them. But it says the human ability to grow enough food to sustain the world's population is truly at risk. These significant declines in populations of managed and native bees and other pollinators are destroying production agriculture. Ken Chandler, director of agricultural studies at Iowa's Gadwell University, says it's going to result in billions of dollars of economic losses to the sector, at the very least, and the national economy by the end of the 2024 growing season. And he says our ability to grow food is no longer a given. You think prices are high now? If the insect population is not able to pollinate? And he talks about, it goes on to say, flowers and pollinators have a close relationship. And we all know how that goes. We saw some bees yesterday in our yard, and there are very few flowers out already. It's a little early here up in the north. But I had some pansies on my deck, and the bumblebees were going after them with their minimal amount of pollen. But they were very attracted to that. The bees are here, and we need to do what we can to at least have some flowers outside so they can pollinate, hummingbirds and all that. The U.S. grows over 100 crop plants that are pollinated by insects and animals. That's 100 different plants. Primary examples include almonds, apples, pears, citrus fruits, cherries, pumpkins, cucumbers, blackberries, cranberries, raspberries, strawberries, blueberries, melons, tomatoes, soybeans, and sunflowers. And that's just a handful of those 100 crop plants. As early as the 1960s, they were talking about the decimation of pollinators. So that's just another perilous thing that we need to look at. And You know, I don't know. Is it too late to save these insect pollinators? I have no idea, and there are various studies out there. But saving the habitat, if we can. I like to grow my flowers and get those critters out there. So I wish I had more better news than that, but you know, you all know we're living in perilous times. So I appreciate my listeners, and we appreciate all the listeners at Q90. We are listener-supported, and we have Q-Drive next week. And we thank you ahead of time for your donations, past, present, and future. So join us next week for Q-Drive. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. 1 Corinthians 15:58. Have a great day on purpose.